It's been very few days. Before we begin, I would like to thank Terry Muir, the author of Our Secretary of Human Rights, and you are not Alex Mooney. And Martha Stewart, Professor of Atlanta for staff and recommending today. Today, the committee will be hearing two presentations from Natasha Singh of the Time Matrix Conference and the Global Warming of the U.S. Federation of Natives. Good morning, ladies. Thank you for joining us this morning. If you could begin by introducing yourself and her and beginning your presentations.
Hi, this is Natasha Singh. Can you hear me? Hello, I'm Natasha Singh. I'm a Stevens Village travel writer. I grew up here in Fairbanks, where I'm calling in from, and I'm general counsel for Canada Chiefs Conference for about 12 years now. We represent the interior tribes, and we are federal government contractors. We actually are a co-signer with the health service, and we provide health care to the interior of Alaska on behalf of the federal government. I met a colleague here, Nicole, at law school at the University of Washington. I'll turn it over to her for her introduction.
That Representative Tarr is also online. I apologize in case that has taken any this program.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Borgia. I serve as the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Alaska Federation of Natives. If you're unfamiliar with our organization, we are the oldest and largest statewide Native organization in the state. We've existed since 1966, originally to negotiate a fair and just settlement of Alaska Native land claims, and subsequently to continue to deal with pressing issues of the day that faces the Alaska Native community. Our 2020 membership includes 9 regional for-profit corporations, 164 village for-profit corporations, all 12 regional nonprofit organizations or regional tribal consortia that contract and contract with the federal government under the Indian Self-Determination Education Assistance Act, which we'll talk about a little later today, and then 169 federally recognized tribes. I've served as general counsel for AFN for the last 7 years, and as Natasha said, we met originally at law school in Utah. I'm an enrolled member to the Clark Native Village, I'm a Donald shareholder, and I also chair a village corporation board, which is MTNT. Very excited to be with you all today and to talk about how we can strengthen Alaska with a stronger partnership between the state and its tribal governments. Okay, well, we just wanted to start off by some basics. And please, if you already know this, we just want to get everyone on the same page so we don't offend you. But we thought it would be good to just start off with some basics on Alaska Natives. So Alaska Natives have 10,000 years of stewardship and connection to these lands now called Alaska. Many of our people still possess intact knowledge systems and connections to place, geographic intelligence. Distinct cultural groups, languages, ways of life, and we have differences and similarities amongst our people. From Haida, Yupik, Athabaskan, and Yupiaks, those are different ethnic and cultural groups, and then we have separate political tribal governments. So just to establish right away that there are 3 sovereigns operating in Alaska at all times. The first sovereign that was here, of course, were the tribes. Then you have the federal government, and then you have the state government. And tribes are recognized in the federal relationship, in the U.S. Constitution, in the Commerce Clause. And since the Constitution, the U.S. Supreme Court has developed case law that really established a strong foundation for the existence existence of trans and the existence in terms of the federal government and the existence of that federal-tribal relationship. And in Alaska, there's over 229 tribes. Did you want to add anything, Nicole?
Yeah, that's just even what I hear talk about when the federal government recognized all Native villages. When the state became a state in 1959 and started selecting lands, and the federal government started selecting lands as well, there was a question about what would happen with all of the people at the Alaska Natives and went on Sans Malina. And as a result, the Department of Interior instituted a land freeze where the federal government and the state was no longer able to select lands until the Klamath title was removed because Alaska Natives claimed ownership of the whole entire state. That ensued years of negotiated discussions between the federal government, state government, and Alaska Natives, and we ended up with the largest private land settlement in the country through the Alaska Natives. That act transferred the retention of 44 million acres of land to Alaska Natives to work corporations. Meanwhile, the lower 48 tribes do not have corporations. Instead, they have a reservation system. And Congress enacted AIDS Act. It was 4 years before the Indian Self-Determination Act, which was a shift in federal policy to begin to build up our tribes and have them, if they wanted to, assume the administration of federal services and supports for their people. So AIDS Act was really a precursor to the shift in federal Indian policy. But as a result of this new age, if you will, it wasn't dealt with at the time where Alaska Natives would stand in terms of our tribalism. And the Land Claims Act never took away tribal status from Alaska. It just didn't speak to it. So in 1994, the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs, Anna Dare, formally recognized all 229 tribes in Alaska. And that is how we got that into the federal agency and Indian law practitioners called the List Act. And we are the List Act major beneficiaries. And Marshall said we have 229 tribes here in Alaska, about 571 throughout the country. So Alaska has about half of the country's tribes right here in our state. And we'll talk about this a little bit later too, but that is an extreme revenue source as well that we can draw down on because of the shift of our tribes within the state. So just how it's expanded. Tribes have existed since the beginning of time here in Alaska. The federal government was silent on status for a long time, surrounding AIDSA, and in 1994 removed all doubt that Alaska Natives still retained tribal status during the court system. Thank you. And just to piggyback off of what Nicole was presenting on all the different tribal entities in the state, different entities really have different missions. And sometimes the missions and the purposes that we serve kind of get mixed up. And so at ANCSA, for-profit regionals often like the top 20 most successful businesses in Alaska. They are profit makers. They're investing in all kinds of industries, and they're there to make shareholders dividends, and they do an amazing job doing that. And their sister organizations are the tribal nonprofits, and that's what Tana Chief says. And we share the same traditional territories, but our duties are very different. We provide and assist the tribes in providing health and social services. And then the tribes themselves are actually the governing bodies of the people. They, for instance, can protect their children. They can issue marriage certificates, divorce
it was at SPAN that we're able to go through agreements. And that's why we're talking today about our compacts and just laying the foundation for the tribal state and federal partnerships. So on my side, the green slide, bonus slide 2, and it explains the different kind of government to government agreements. And you have federal state compacts, and you see this like in the child foster campaign is before any agreements. That's a federal state partnership, and the tribes are able to join that one too. And then there's the federal tribal agreements. That's like Indian Health Service and the Alaska Native Tribal Health System. That's agreement tribes and state. Then you have state to state agreements. I've seen this in my work with child custody issues. States to states have agreements between the states on how to deal with jurisdiction and when parents are in different states and how to deal with visits. Then you have state to tribe. You can see this, and I'm just going to dive into this with the child protection compact. And then you have tribe to tribe agreements. So in the Ontario, we have tribe to tribe agreements regarding our fish commission, child custody, and child protection. Those are just some examples. Please, next slide.
Hey, Natasha.
Yes.
I'll just add for basic understanding to make sure that we're all on the same page here about what a compact is, because we use a terminology that we have just grown up with, that maybe some members of the committee or those in the board, a lot of people that are listening might not be familiar with. But a compact is essentially passing word for agreement between two sovereign entities in this case, and that's how we're using it. So when you hear compact, just think to yourself, it's an agreement between two sovereigns, whether it be the federal, state, or tribal government.
Thank you, Nicole.
Yes.
Okay.
Next slide.
Yes, the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Acts. Okay, so this is the major federal law that was championed by President Nixon. And yes, what this did is states across the country, after this law was passed, was able to get into this agreement with the federal agencies to take over federal agencies' responsibilities to provide services to tribes. And before this act was passed, the federal government did not have a successful federal Indian policy. You had the colonial era, then you had the Ivory era, then you had the termination era, and then the federal government still did not know how to deal with us natives. What are they going to do with us? Well, the fact came out of really President Nixon's think tank, and he had a special relationship with some Native Americans, and he went to them and said, "What should we do?" And they said, "Give us control. Give us local control. We know what we should do. We know how to provide services to our people. We know what's best." And that's really what the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act stands for. It's letting Native people implement the programs for their people. And it's just awesome that it's so bipartisan, supported. It's a really Republican owned and grown policy, and it's always supported by both parties. And I think that's just really unique in kind of our current system. Next slide, please. So, again, when we enter into agreements under the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act, this is a political agreements between the federal government and the tribe. They're not race So that means that's why Tamarack Chiefs Conference is able to provide services to non-tribal members. It's because the tribal governments are allowed to determine who they serve and we're able to serve non-tribal members that live in our communities and veterans in our healthcare agreement. Okay. Absolutely. And that's a really important point, and you have to have fundamental understanding of this principle. Otherwise, a lot of other aspects of federal Indian law and how the state deals with crops here in Alaska won't make sense. I can't underscore enough that this is not a race-based view of Alaska states or American Indians and how the government interacts with us is a political status, and as we noted at the beginning of the presentation, our political status creates the foundation of the United States and the Constitution. This is submitted in the U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence from the earliest bench in the Marshall Trilogy, and the court has, throughout the decades and centuries, even upheld the principle that when the federal government legislates on behalf of Alaska Native and American Indians, it does not do so in a race-based standing. That's why we are always able to overcome protection challenges. Federal
disability. And again, that is grounded in pre-Constitution medical travel treaties, the Constitution itself, and then the U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence. So whenever the federal government deals with married people, they do so to have a vision of holding the high legal and moral obligations to American Indians and other natives.
Can you explain the term preference that means that you have that predate the Constitution or is by law that you remain the voting
group? Thank you. Representative Fielder, through the chair. The trust responsibility is a unique term when we're talking about federal Indian law. And it's maybe what I was explaining is granted as I thought I was. But the Supreme Court has held that the federal government does owe federally recognized tribes a trust responsibility. That means the federal government needs to be acting in the best interest of federally recognized tribes and individual Indian beneficiaries at all times when they're dealing with Native people on their issues. And they have very clearly stated that this obligation is rooted in the federal tribal treaties that existed before the Constitution and before the United States were officially formed. They borrowed principles of trust estates law, and that's why we call it a trust responsibility, because it's very much like a trustee to a beneficiary. That's the analogy that the Supreme Court has used. But when we talk about federal Indian law and the trust responsibility that is owed to our tribes and to our individual Indian beneficiaries, it's not exactly like the trust responsibility that would come from us and states in that relationship, but it's similar.
Thank you.
And it's kind of a little bit, when I've explained this in the past, people are like, oh, the federal government hasn't actually treated tribes with its best responsibility of moral obligations. So then you're like, how is that? So it's just the Supreme Court has said this for hundreds of years, and we're building off of this. And I think that administration and Congress just caught up to the fact that that's what the Supreme Court has said the law is. And you really see that reflected in Inmates of Determination and Education Assistance Act. That's the first policy that's been, the first and only policy that's been successful, because it's basically saying, we're not going to dictate to you tribes on how you should do things. We're actually going to give the authority to you, and you do your thing. And that's exactly what we're doing for Indian Service Compact. And just to break it down a little, the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act on Slide 5 has different titles, and it's broken down between a contract and a compact. Now, in Title 1 of the statute, tribes are able to enter into contracts with the Indian Health Service. And this is done for a tribal resolution, and that it's dictated through well-developed federal regulations, but it's less flexibility and less control. We have to still kind of fit into a box determined by any health service, and we have to follow pretty closely what they tell us to do. It's more flexibility than a grant. And I should have put DHS grants on a left column so you could compare grants, contracts, and compacts. But it's still a step towards self-governance for our tribes, the contract. And then in the contacts, those are under Title 5,
relationship as a contractor on the Title I for any health service to consider you to move towards Title V. So there's a planning phase to move from Title I to Title V. You have to show all of your historical documentation, your audits, to just show that you're doing your job as a tribe and you're doing your job as a party to a legal agreement. And there's way more flexibility and there's way more local control in the contracts. So, for instance, the way it works for us, the tribal health system, is Congress appropriates funding to the Indian Health Service, and that funding is distributed among the 12 regions in the nation. Alaska gets the one part of funding. We get 40% of all the health funding that goes to Indian Country in Alaska. So we do quite well. And once the funding hits the Alaska Area Office, our tribes come together and determine how it is divided amongst themselves. And we do that without Indian Health Service present, and it's a negotiation between tribe to tribe. We then invite the Indian Health Service, and we speak with one voice, all tribes to the Indian Health Service under one contract. And then we negotiate with Indian Health Service how the funding is distributed. Then when the funding is distributed to all the various co-signers to the compact, we have 25 co-signers to the Indian Health Service compact, and Canada Chiefs Conference is just one of those signers. That funding is distributed to Canada Chiefs Conference, and our tribal leaders determine how we spend that money on what programs. So if our tribal leaders say, listen, we are, just for example, if funding's in the interior, we're dealing with a meth epidemic, and our tribes are like, we need you to invest in prevention and treatment. And then we're allowed to take that direction and use that flexibility to develop programs to do just that. Programs that are culturally acceptable and relevant. But we're not able to do in grants. Grants are very specific at those of what is needed. And the beauty of an Indian self-determination contract is it's not DC telling us what we need to do to keep our people off of drugs. It's we know how to keep our people off of drugs, and we'll use that funding to do it. The next slide gets into the different federal possibilities for contracting. So I was just talking about the U.S. Tribal Health System and our agreement with Indian Health Service and the Secretary of Health. There is also the Department of Interior and our agreements, our tribal agreements with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So, the Health and Human Services side, we have our tribes are dealing with community health services, which includes dental and behavioral health, optometry. We have research and data, technology, we have health training, rural energy, sanitation, water and sewer, and then wellness and prevention. So we're doing a lot of areas of health in our Western Tribal Health System. And then on the Bureau of Indian Affairs side and the Department of Interior, we're dealing with child and family services, economic development, education and employment training, elder services, natural resources. This is where you hear our fish commissions and our other agreements with the federal government regarding hunting. Public safety is a high priority for rural Alaska. TANA, our Native communities, our elders, our women of pride, so are our veterans. We just have a very high respect for them. We have a lot of non-tribal member veterans living in our communities, and it is such an honor that our tribal clients are able to serve them. And we have, and that's because we have agreements with the veterans affairs. And so we're just better able to have that coordination of care. And we have several agreements with the state of Alaska, which we'd like to further develop in order to have that smooth system. And having patients live in the most remote part of the countries and having to come into a sub-regional hub clinic and then another city of Fairbanks and then travel to Anchorage, there's a lot of things that can go wrong when you're trying to coordinate all that care between various levels of providers. And so we feel that we've developed a system where that's possible. There's always a need for improvement, but we're coordinating a lot of geographic logistics that we've just developed over time. And then, of course, the benefits to the state is that cost savings. What we're bringing to the table for the state of Alaska. I think these figures are, so these figures demonstrate how much savings Medicaid has brought the state. And I would just like to point out that because of federal law, the Native patients that are on Medicaid, the state gets 100% coverage for our patients. The state is not paying one penny towards Medicaid because that is how the system was set up by Congress. So our tribal health system is bringing all that savings just to Medicaid, and we should develop further the savings from both of our contracts with the Department of Interior and the Department of Health.
Discussions around compacting the trip that Nicole, as you talk about your Alaska tribal town hall for compacting going to make a little bit over. I think this touches on this really well. And that's, there's been some dialogue in this building, particularly in an environment of decreased state spending, where compacting is viewed as an opportunity to save the state money. But I think that is moving misunderstanding of the role of compacting, particularly as it relates to the benefits of it. So can you really touch on just a little bit more this idea of leveraging partnerships both for the savings aspect and can you underscore maybe with an example about improved program efficiency, particularly that you saw through some ongoing dialogue with the Department of Health and Social Services. And then a lot of programs that are in crisis within the Department of Health and Social Services. So where would the role of compacting and agreeing with tribes be able to provide benefit to those types of programs?
Sure. So 10 years ago, when I got to Canada Chiefs Conference, our programs, even though we're under one roof, we have different various programs, women in training, education, clinical health, tribal services, and are all in these silos. But it was our patients might as well, and client tribal members might as well be dealing with separate entities when they walked in our door to get services. But as
Some of the
super small village, so they're having difficulty at that 10-child threshold, and it's expensive for the school district to keep the doors open in the village. So that village is really interested in contracting. They would like to take over the school, and they want to explore how to do that. They have, the reason they are interested is they have a few tribal member teachers that make up their 60-member population. They have like a PhD in education, and they have a few other tribal teachers. So they have a very unique situation that they would be amazing to take over their school and just implement what's best for them. Public safety is another one that tribes are interested in taking over. So we're both pursuing changes within the Big Bad South program, but we're also pursuing opportunities with the federal government in public safety. And transportation is another huge opportunity for the Department of Transportation here in the state.
In relationship to potential contacts in the area of education, has there been outside of village or community specific, has there been discussion as to what that would look like in relationship to what currently happens? Education in the different tribal groups compared to if they were in contact, in what ways would that education look different? Have there been that kind of discussions?
Nicole, have you been involved in those discussions? I can get back to you on that one. I'm sure our education staff here at TCC have been involved in what exactly that looks like and kind of penciled it out. I don't have the specifics. I know Ross Madison Crowe from First Alaskans has done some discussions with tribes on what that might look like. Nicole, have you been involved?
Those discussions are in the preliminary stages right now. It all starts with a willing participant in the role in Hershey Hoffman has been a real champion for education in Alaska, rural Alaska in particular. And when we were negotiating the child welfare contract, he got word of it, became very excited, and thought that this may be a tool to use for the state and particularly in rural areas that some hardship has been in the making there for quite some time. So we're not close per se to negotiating education contract, and that's going to be a bit different than the child welfare contract we talked about in a minute, because you have the school board and a third party, and you really need to buy it from the whole entire community and region to the larger extent. Because it's just different from the two-party negotiations that we typically deal with in the role of contracting. But that's not to say that these conversations aren't happening. They're just not maybe as far down the road as we would hope at this point.
Thank you.
Representative, do you have any
questions? Thank you, Roger. This is more for the cost. So the faster that you guys talk with all the people in the youth community, and has there been any discussion the possible native border school, regional school in that area? I guess chatting with some people, not familiar with it, and it was something they brought up. And so I just wanted to ask you that question, if there's been any thoughts or discussions.
I haven't been involved in those discussions. I know TCC has a resolution in place that we kind of have a policy that we don't like to develop those boarding school homes. So then we'd like to implement a system just because I'm
is. So we haven't been involved in a boarding school for Eastern Interior, but I'm meeting with our chief this week, and I will definitely ask them and get back to you on that one.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Maybe I have reached a level of detail with respect to growth mechanism education contacting. Can it be done in such a way that maybe it's finally for teachers who maybe have been 3 years, maybe there are any numbers that have some benefits that they're accruing? Can you make that happen really effectively with a different employer where your employer is, I guess, private versus local school district? Or maybe it's not a different employer because it's quite an issue. I don't know how much I can afford to find a reason to be in place.
Well, we definitely, that's definitely on the list, and it's going to be a huge barrier right to recruitment if we have this whole different system, and the benefits don't match up, and there's no that continuity. So thank you for pointing that out, and we agree that that is going to be something we're going to have to all work out, and this is going to be successful. Just for this final slide, this goes over consultation. Consultation is an important part of a government-to-government relationship. It's basically a formal process to say, let's communicate in a good way. Let's keep each other informed. We'll give you a heads up on things we might be thinking about. Even before we put pen to paper, we're going to consult with each other. And that's really the basis for why consultation is that when you have these different sovereigns working in the same arenas. So, for instance, on the Indian Health Service side, when they're just thinking of an idea, they'll implement that consultation policy. We'll be triggering it, and they'll say, hey, Jackson, this is what we're thinking. Help us think through this so we don't start down this rabbit hole that isn't going to work for you. And then we'll say, okay, I see where, you know, you want to make this change. This is where we think you should take this when you go under developing regulation. Whatever you want to do. And then that kind of steers them in the right direction. That's the beauty of consultation, that there's transparency, that there's respect for the other party, there's good communication, and it's really what's needed. I think some of the breakdown in Governor Dunleavy's executive order was that that really didn't happen, that heads up wasn't given, that discussion wasn't given on the front end, and the stakeholders really couldn't shape what benefit Alaska. So consultation is so important when dealing with all the sovereigns in the same area. Consultations can happen in a very formal manner at very specific times in potential policy changes, or it can happen in a less formal manner. But the important part is that the respect is maintained, great communication, and transparency. So that's what it was.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question from Monte. So, as a retired teacher and a remote learning, what is your vision on the compacting with the current, labor money schools right now?
protection role. VTRAC also has access to funding for treatment. So the TRAC will pull that family together. If the children are substance abusing, you know what the parents are. The TRAC can pull them together. They have the authority to tell that family, this is what a case plan looks like for you. And you're going to be working with the school and counseling with the school, and this is what's going to happen. That's the kind of mission for specific communities that actually really need it. And it doesn't have to take the form of contact for education. We can actually do those agreements without the contacting, but maybe, for instance, with a village like Beaver, where they are teetering on a 10-child child from the homegrown teachers and have access to foundational funding that could help them so that they leverage that resources. Maybe that's where we see that vision. And there's just so many possibilities to explore in our villages on how to vary health and social services with the education system. So that's kind of our TCC's ideas of just using different, breaking down those silos and trying to bring human and wellness at the core of our families.
I thank you, Josh. That was a great advice. And I know our district is working very hard to build those relationships, and we still have a ton of work to do. You know, for example, during COVID, I'm not on the board anymore. I'm not on the top of the superintendent, we can manage, and we allow the villagers to choose when the level is high enough to just close the school down. And, so some of our schools are going to be going into June because, we have these closures, and I really appreciate the willingness of the villages to work with the schools to do what's best for the village and the education system. So I appreciate your explanation, and I look forward to working with you guys to keep expanding this so we can do the best job possible. Thank you. Expand for the other entities. And that's the plan.
tribes are have very low populations, and they don't have the human resources to implement the full self-governance programs. So JCC houses their programs here, and we employ our staff to deliver those services. Another tribe
from both
how they could better support each other. The goal in the child welfare cooperation group for the state and tribes is to strengthen laws of compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, known as ICWA. That law was passed by Congress in 1978 to keep Native children in Native homes. There was a lot of pairing almost of children in Native homes by outside private adoption and foster care agencies that would come onto reservations or come into Indian homes and see things that didn't look familiar to them. They were often run by non-Native social workers, and they didn't understand concepts like poverty, overcrowding, generational living. And to them, it looked like this family was in crisis when oftentimes they were not in crisis. And as a result, the children were being removed. So Congress stepped in, again, because it exercises plenary power over American Indians and Alaska Natives, and passed the Indian Child Welfare Act with the goal to keep Native children in Native homes. The state of Alaska has a checkered history in terms of compliance, but as of recently, there has been a better effort on the state to comply with the Indian Child Welfare Act, and they've come a long way there. The other reason that the Tribal State Collaboration Group got together was, again, to reduce the disproportionality, of Indian children in state custody. And you can see there that I have India in quotation marks because this is a legally defined term. You have to meet the federal definition of being Indian, which means that you are involved or eligible for enrollment in a tribe. That is how an Indian child, a Alaska Native child, would come under the protection of ICWA. And finally, the goal was to really build and then strengthen those relationships on both the tribe and state sides and working together. The compact also came out of tribal 4E agreements. 4E refers to a specific section of the Social Security Act, and what it does is these agreements provide federal resources, money, to states and to tribes to provide foster care, transitional independent living programs, guardianship assistance, and adoption assistance. It's super important to understand here that tribes receive a higher reimbursement rate than the state of Alaska ever will for covered services. This will result in significant general fund savings if the state of Alaska is able to maximize these tribal 4E agreements. And Alaska has done a fairly good job of this. Christy Swanson, who recently retired from OPS, is a resident expert on this, so right from that name, she's still alive, you know, and is a consultant now that has been hired by Casey Family Programs to help with the implementation of the compact. Next slide, please, Logan. Many basics, building blocks here on what the Child Welfare Compact is. As we talked about in the last presentation on the federal side, a compact is just an intergovernmental agreement between two sovereigns. In this case, we're talking about the state of Alaska and 18 either federally recognized tribes or their tribal organizations. Natasha works for TCC, that's a regional tribal organization. That organization receives its delegated authority from its member tribes. That is how TCC is able to enter into compacts, and that is how some of these organizations as well enter into compacts through resolutions from their tribes. Now, there's the state of Alaska as one sovereign, and on the other side, there's 18 what we call tribal co-signers, and that's a mix of 11 different regional nonprofits or a regional tribal consortia and a handful of just individual tribes. The goal here is to provide higher quality services and support at a lower cost. And again, right back up to the previous goal that I skipped over this is the agreement is meant to improve the life outcomes of Alaska's children, not just Alaska's Native children, and not just Native families, but Alaska's children and families, by transferring negotiated child welfare services and support to tribes. And the key term there is negotiated. So this isn't something where the state enters the room and decides to offload all of its problem areas in OCS, or that the tribe shows up and gets cherry-pick which services and supports that it actually hosts. The parties come together and there's back and forth about which services and supports and which programs and functions of those services and supports will come over to the tribe through the contract. The precedence for this model, again, is rooted in the Indians of Determination Education Assistance Act. Those health contracts and those BIA contracts that Natasha was talking about with the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Health on the federal side, that really provided the model here in Alaska for us to go ahead and move in this direction. It was extremely timely when we did this under the previous administration, which was the Obama-Reagan administration, because Commissioner Val Davidson, Lieutenant Governor Val Davidson as well, used to and is now back at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, where she has decades of experience in negotiating these contracts and implementing these contracts as well. She is probably the most seasoned expert in the state of Alaska on contracts, and a little bit busy right now with two hats. But if there's an opportunity to have her before the committee for any follow-up questions or another hearing, she would be another excellent witness here. But the precedence in these contracts really, again, came from the federal government, and we took what we liked in those model of negotiations and applied it to our negotiations in the Child Welfare Compact. Our work for the Child Welfare Compact is incredibly meaningful, but more than that, it's also historic. This is the first time that a government-to-government negotiated agreement has ever been executed at the state level. So we are, as I like to say, on the cutting edge of both law and policy. We have the eyes of the nation, a lot of tribes in Lower 48 Indian country that are looking to Alaska to see how this is going and thinking about how they can go ahead and adapt the work that we've done here in the state to their tribal child welfare needs and their reservations or respective tribal communities. And really, the final point I want to make here is that the contract recognizes the inherent authority of federally recognized tribes to provide child welfare services and supports to their members. And I know that sometimes tribes can be a little bit of an uncomfortable word if you're a non-tribal member, but really what I like to tell policymakers is to think about tribes as another term for local government, because that's what the tribes are at the end of the day. This is about a local government exercising local control, and there's nothing to be afraid of in the word tribes. Next slide, please, Robert. This slide here is a list of all of the different 18 tribal code signers. The big takeaway here is that all of these different tribal organizations and tribes represent 161 individual Alaska tribes. That is more villages and communities than the state of Alaska could ever hope to be operating child welfare programs in. So this is a humongous benefit to the state of Alaska to have these tribal co-signers that are willing to provide these services in all areas of the state, because having this representation is just not possible through the current model that the state implements now without the tribal co-signers coming to the table and providing it in their communities. Are there any questions here before I keep going? Really quick to talk about the implementation timeline for the Child Welfare Compact. Again, this compact was, I like to say, conceived under the previous administration, the Obama administration, but it has grown past infancy and still around where the end of the infancy under the current administration of Governor Dunleavy. So we sat down in 2017 and really embarked on a very aggressive negotiation schedule for this contract. The previous administration had identified as one of its goals for the Department of Health and Social Services at the commissioner level, child welfare. This is an area that has needed commissioner attention for quite some time, and Commissioner Davidson, who later became lieutenant governor, publicly committed and personally dedicated her time to making this a real priority for the department. So we started negotiating the compact in April of 2017. We came together in Anchorage, that is the geographical central location. But in terms of transportation and logistics, it was the easiest for us to meet in Anchorage. So we met in Anchorage once a month from April until October of 2017 with the goal to sign the compact in the annual Western Federation of Natives Convention, which we did. We would set out anywhere from 3 consecutive days to sometimes 5 consecutive days to negotiate the compact. The compact has many different sections, starting with, a purpose, definitions, who the parties are, what we hope to accomplish through the compact, and the different services and supports that the tribes can negotiate to take over. We call them slopes of work. There are a number of them, I think, that they can take over. And we saved the best for us in terms of the subject matter that we had to grant on, which was tribal sovereignty. And that had been a subject that was really difficult for the state and the tribes to both come together on. And through this contact, we were able to negotiate what was the first limited waiver of tribal sovereign immunity. And that allowed more tribes to sign on to the contact and to be tribal co-signers. The state was very respective and understanding of what tribal sovereignty was. And they were asking the tribes to just engage in blanket waivers, and that helped pave the way to sign the contact. The first year of the compact was in fiscal year 2018. This is when the tribal co-signers either developed a tribal child welfare program if they didn't have one of their own, or if they had an existing program, many of them just redesigned their programs. They took big influx of the state money that would come to them, and they didn't necessarily hire on another staff. They just divided up the current responsibilities among the current staff or hire a consultant for certain things or brought on a part-time worker. But this wasn't just to fill bodies in the tribal child welfare programs of their respective organizations and tribes. This was to think about what made sense for them. As the pastor talked about in the TCC region, sometimes the exercise of tribal self-determination is not doing anything different. And that's what some of the folks I understand here. Is they kept their program intact as it was, and then just added on more responsibility. They also built capacity during FY18 and built up their infrastructure. The state, for the first time, began sharing PSRs, protective service reports. These are sometimes known as the screening or screening out reports. This had been a sticking point for tribes and many of the organizations too for decades, because what the tribes have been telling OCS is that they wanted to know the first time that OCS had contact with one of their families. And OCS would say, we really want to be able to bring them into this, but there's always confidentiality barriers and statute that we can't provide the BFRs to. And what the contact did is it provided a workaround to that impediment. And as a result, OCS has begun sharing the PSRs with the tribes, so the tribes are able to reach out to the family and to prevent further interactions with either its child welfare program or OCS as a result. The state also began providing training and technical support. FY18 was a very short year, so this was about all that could have been accomplished in those 6 months before moving into FY19. When FY19 came around, the state and tribes once again joined for annual negotiations. Annual negotiations are 2.5 days under the rules that the state and the co-signers developed. There needs to be a tribal leader in the room that is physically present and or a subject matter expert. The reason for that is that the contact process moves very quickly, and there's not always time to call back to the region to get a yes or no or answer, call back and figure out how the program really works. So the tribes have been very diligent in making sure that staff, I'm sure, type of negotiations when we sit down. In FY19, the tribal co-signers began to form the first form of work, which was the initial village and relative searches. This is when a child enters the state system. Under ICWA, there's a placement reference that an Indian child should be placed in an Indian home or a native home. Sometimes the state of Alaska or the child welfare program of the tribe in some cases doesn't necessarily know who all of the child's relatives are. So this was a significant benefit for the state to have the tribes take over its aspect, because a lot of times the child could be intimacy service, someone's niece, nephew, cousin, and they'll know just instinctively who the family is. In FY19, the parties also negotiated for a baseball support for ongoing relative searches. These are the searches that take place after the initial search, family contact, which is monitored supervision between the child and his or her parents, licensing assists, these are foster care licensing, evaluations of homes, and then safety evaluations, which ties into whether or not a home is safe or not. Unfortunately, there was a change of administration at the same time, and the new administration decided to just push pause on the compact, so none of these were implemented in FY29, even though they were ready to go. They were just shelved, if you will, over the new administration. We set its policy priorities and evaluated whether or not it would continue with the child welfare compacts. Next slide. FY20, the parties have worked out their differences. The Delaware administration committed to continuing all of the child welfare compacts, and all five of those previous negotiated filters were then signed and implemented, and the tribes have started to take on the different aspects of all of these filters that are listed there. For FY21, we are going to have negotiations in May of 2021, so those are coming up. And we'll have more to report the next time we talk to the committee or to the legislature on the election time.
So before you go on, I just said, one question that comes to mind for myself is, we've heard commitments in this building about full support of the tribal job offer compact. Can you describe from a tribal co-signer's perspective, if the state is making assertions that it fully supports the tribal child welfare compact, what does that look like in functionality? What does that mean in the scope of these agreements or the execution of these agreements?
Thank you for that question. And I guess I should tell everyone else that if you don't know, I also happen to facilitate the negotiations between the state and the tribes for the child welfare compact. In addition to my VTO, this is my other job, being one of the facilitators. I often ask Joe and Karen, and other places to talk about the compact. And I should have mentioned that at the beginning of the presentation. I'm sorry that I didn't. The state has, as you mentioned, indicated its support of the compact. The impediments, if I could identify some, is, well, the funding stream has been held constant since the beginning of this, and we're now moving into the fourth cycle here, and the state hasn't added any more money to the scope of work, even though the tribes are being asked to take on more. So at some point, this is going to become too challenging for the tribes to continue to underwrite this without the state adding some resources to the compact. And another impediment is just like I said, with the change in administration and new people coming in and out, is that we are constantly having to go back to square one and educate new members of the administration, our new policymakers, on what the compact is, what the benefits are, how we grow up here. And that's the amount there that it's just a addition to the time and why we're not having full implementation. Also, the child welfare platform
to continue on this path, but not have to help strengthen it as well as the website language. Right now, this is operating out of the executive branch, which, as I alluded to on the previous slide, has led to some delay in terms of one administration not wanting to necessarily pick up where the other one kind of left off. So those are all challenges that we have had to overcome throughout this process.
That number may be
we need to turn the page on around horrific numbers of the last minute children in state custody.
I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the May 2021 meeting and what we might expect. Or is there something that we should be thinking about in preparation for that meeting that might help move things along? Or in the legislature, just curious if you have an opportunity or anything you should be thinking about. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. I'm going to interrupt you too. It might be helpful if the legislature could think about a direct appropriation to the bond. A carve-out, if you will, not sure the terminology that the building these days for that is, but that would be a strong signal to the state negotiators that the legislative branch supports the work of the carve-out and what we're trying to accomplish through this agreement. And I think that the tribes and the state have a lot on their plate with the five scopes of work that they're trying to implement now. I don't know how much more tribal consortiums, quite honestly, could take on without additional resources. So resources is going to be important. And another thing for the legislation to think about is potentially drafting legislation that would cement this in given statute. So NOCAP is more permanent and stable and not as we approach 2020 and hanging in a balance of an election.
Thanks, Lucia. On the legislative front, we've been directed at the Ohio Manor for drafting legislation for us to contemplate.
Representative, thank you for sharing that we've not started drafting legislation.
I know that the most recent federal aid package that passed, there's going to be some specific funding for child abuse prevention and family violence prevention. I don't know if you've had a chance to study that yet. Do you have any idea whether we could look at, if you have a lot of these funds, if this would be an allowable purpose? It's just something that I read about more recently, and I want to understand better how we can use those funds.
Thank you, Representative Todd, for the chair. We've not had an opportunity, those associated with the contract yet, to delve into that level of detail, but I have done the early reading that you were just referring to as well, and it does appear that some of those funds could be steered toward the contract. And if those particular funds can't be, then the funds that were otherwise used for those areas of law could be framework that dedicated toward the compact. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. One of the most, I think, exciting aspects of the Alaska Child Welfare Compact is we get to see a public-private partnership up close and personal in the making. And what we've done here in Alaska is so innovative, so on the cutting edge of modern policy. By taking the federal contact model, applying it to child welfare service, we have probably an inch of case development programs. Case development programs is the largest foster care and related services foundation in the country. And they were very eager to partner with us on this endeavor. They invested a small amount of seed money in the initial negotiations in 2017 to allow us to get off the starting block. And as a result, they have stayed well throughout the process. They now have hired a couple of different consultants and have detailed those consultants to the contract because we had a lot of jam in terms of implementation. We couldn't quite figure out what was going wrong and why the services and supports weren't being implemented in the way that we thought that they would be implemented. So we've got two consultants now with case academic programs that are helping identify where those gaps are on the state side and on the tribe side. And again, this is another just history-making aspect of the compact. Not only have we negotiated the first tribal-state compact, but we've also, in the process, done the first public-private partnership with the child welfare system. So these are two great big items that we should be celebrating Beloved. So to wrap things up, the long-term goals of the compact are really simple. We want Alaska children and families to be served locally as close to home as possible. And as I said before, local needs travel in a lot of cases. Because there's no way that the state of Alaska is going to be able without dedicating millions of dollars to have offices and a presence in 161 Native villages and communities throughout the state without partnering with tribal organizations and tribes. We want services to be provided in a more cost-efficient manner, and we want those services to be higher quality. And as we look at what the AANC campus is now, Alaska Native Medical Center campuses compared to the old Alaska Native Services campus, way back in the day, we know that we can get there. And we know that tribal, local tribal ideas and thoughts and action can produce a product that's like our tribal healthcare system. We want children and families to be more receptive to changing abusive behaviors and neglectful behaviors and to decrease the number of children in state custody. And we want to improve the life outcomes of all Alaska children, particularly Alaska Native children, because those children tend to enter the foster care system in such a higher number than other non-natives within Alaska. For your time today, if there's any questions, I'm happy to take them. And just really appreciate the work and dedication of all of you in the room. Thank you.
Savings in the general fund. We were taking care of the external compact as the most driving to the state. But that's a lot of appreciation. Differences in reimbursement. Do you help me understand this?
Thank you for that question, Representative Fields, and to the chair. Those numbers change on an annual basis. So when I was talking about the Title 14 agreements, for example, if we look at foster care and we use the Rogers region, TCC, which is also my home region, the state is reimbursed for foster care services from the federal government at a rate of about 50%, whereas if the tribes draw down and request reimbursement, the tribe is reimbursed anywhere from 65% to 80%. So that much more money is coming from the federal government. And if we have an opportunity as Alaska to get a reimbursement rate of 50% from the federal government or 80% from the federal government, and therefore only have to kick in the other 20% from the general fund, it seems like a no-brainer that we would want to do the math in a way that saves the state more money and is able to deliver services closer to home that are higher quality.
Structures around tribes and complex relationships between the various levels of government. Thank you both so much for all of the work that you do on behalf of Alaska Native people, our communities, as well as the organizations that do such difficult but necessary work within our communities. So thank you both for all that you do. This brings us to the conclusion of today's Tribe Affairs meeting. Our next meeting will be Thursday, March 18th at 8 a.m. here in Davidson, 106. We will have a hearing on the role of tribal health organizations in Alaska.